KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Most CEOs I talk to would say we are probably in a recession right now.
It was another volatile day on Wall Street with the markets closing down and more. President Trump's tariffs are set to go into effect tonight.
For Tuesday, April 8th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. In upstate New York, the small town of Sackett's Harbor is embracing a migrant family.
Three students and their mother who were arrested by immigration agents are now coming home.
A lot of places probably would have just been like, oh, that sucks, they're gone. They wouldn't have done anything about it. But I think because this is such a small community, everybody came together.
Later, we meet Susie Hicks, the climate chick.
She's got a new YouTube series inspiring kids to take action on climate change.
All of my friends have like normal 9-to-5s. And they have healthcare and like they make money, and I'm out here like playing with puppets talking about the earth.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Supreme Court has ruled the Trump administration's firing of probationary employees at six agencies can stand for now. Justices ruling the plaintiffs in the case, a group of nonprofits, did not have standing. More from NPR's Andrea Hsu.
The decision from the High Court halts a ruling by U.S. District Judge William Alsup last month. Alsup had ordered six federal agencies to bring some 16,000 probationary employees back to work. Some of those employees were also reinstated under a different federal court order issued that same day in a case brought by 19 states and the District of Columbia. It's unclear what agencies will do now, whether they'll attempt to sort out who among the reinstated probationary employees can now be fired once again. With this decision, the Supreme Court is not addressing the question at the heart of the case, whether or not the firings were legal. That's still making its way through the lower courts. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
President Trump took executive actions today he says will revive the coal industry. Piers Moore Lyson has the story.
Standing in front of a group of coal miners wearing work uniforms and hard hats, President Trump signed orders that would remove regulations for new coal mines and expedite leases for coal mining on federal land. He said the orders would crush Biden-era environmental restrictions.
For four long years, Joe Biden and congressional Democrats tried to abolish the American coal industry. They did everything in their power while he was awake, which wasn't much, shutting down dozens of coal plants.
Coal mining's decline began in the 1980s, and more recently, it's lost ground to low-cost fracking. That's on top of environmental regulation. As for coal's contribution to climate change, Trump said sea level rise would create, quote, a little bit more waterfront property. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
Measles cases in West Texas have now surpassed 500 in a continuing outbreak. Libby Aldridge with member station KUT reports.
Texas's state health department also announced that ongoing transmission of measles had spread to several new counties. Public health experts continue to say the best way to curb the outbreak is to drive up the vaccination rate. Jennifer Nuzzo is the director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University School of Public Health.
That's the way to stop it. This only ends with immunity.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. visited Texas over the weekend after a second child died in the outbreak. He said in a statement that vaccines are the most effective way to prevent the spread of measles, after previously promoting unproven alternative treatments for the disease. I'm Olivia Aldridge in Austin.
When stock markets show nearly 1,500-point swings in a single trading day, it's pretty safe to say investors are confused. That sums up today's buying and selling on Wall Street ahead of the Trump administration tariffs. The Dow fell 320 points. This is NPR. An old album is returning to the top of the pop charts. That is thanks to a deluxe edition containing new songs. NPR's Stephen Thompson has this report.
For the last 2 weeks, Playboi Carti has topped the Billboard albums chart with a brand new record called Music. But this week, it's been replaced by an album that topped the chart more than a year ago. Ariana Grande recently reissued her 2024 album Eternal Sunshine with five new songs and an extended version of another. With six fresh tracks and fresh vinyl and CD editions for sale, the album leapt from number 87 all the way back to number one. The Wicked star also landed all six of those new tracks in the Billboard Hot 100, with Twilight Zone hitting the top 20. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
Sotheby's Auction House is calling it a major display of important rare diamonds. $100 million worth of rare diamonds on display at the United Arab Emirates capital, Abu Dhabi. The diamonds being shown have a total weight of more than 700 carats. Visitors, however, have been largely focused on a 10-carat blue diamond from South Africa. Considered one of the most significant stones in the world, it's due to be auctioned off in May. Estimates are the stone could fetch $20 million or more. Crude oil futures prices continued their downward slide, reaching four-year lows as inflation fears mount over a looming conflict between the U.S. and China over trade. Oil fell $1.12 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The stock market had another volatile day. U.S. stocks bounced back and forth after several days of sell-offs in reaction to President Trump's announcement of global trading tariffs. Investors hope Trump will strike more deals with major trading partners to soften his new tariffs, but many remain worried about long-term damage. And the White House has said that more tariffs will go into effect tonight. NPR's Maria Assman is here to talk to us about what's going on. Hi there.
Hi there.
So, Maria, I understand it was another wild, wild day on Wall Street today. Where did things end up?
Juana, I was hoping to have some not terrible news for you for once, but it was another chaotic day that started off well and turned into a sell-off by the end. The Dow closed down 320 points, or just under 1%. The S&P 500 and the tech-heavy NASDAQ also fell. This all came as President Trump and his advisors talked about negotiating with more of the countries they've slapped tariffs on. This is Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent on CNBC this morning.
If they come to the table with solid proposals, I think we can end up with some good deals.
But what we saw happen next, the White House signals it might be open to negotiation and the markets bounce back for a while. It all underlines just how much of this ongoing crisis has been caused by President Trump's tariffs. Economists across the political spectrum have been warning for months that these taxes will increase prices for consumers and could push the country and the world into a recession. Earlier this week, we saw some prominent CEOs, like JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, start to speak out against the tariffs. And now they've been joined by more business leaders, even ones who have otherwise been very pro-Trump.
Interesting. What are they saying?
The billionaires are starting to get worried. For example, Ken Langone. He's the billionaire co-founder of Home Depot and a Republican donor. And he told the Financial Times that the president was being poorly advised. And then he used an expletive I can't repeat on the air to describe Trump's 46% tariff on Vietnam, where I should mention Home Depot sources a lot of its products. There was also BlackRock CEO Larry Fink, who spoke at the Economic Club of New York yesterday. He said the tariffs have already damaged the economy.
Most CEOs I talked to would say we are probably in a recession right now.
To be clear, the data does not show that we're in a recession right now, but there are mounting warnings that the tariffs are going to push us into one. Now, most CEOs have been pretty reluctant to criticize Trump in public, so the fact that more are speaking out now gives you an idea of just how worried they are about the damage the tariffs can cause. And we should note that even Elon Musk, the Tesla CEO who's Trump's close advisor and one of the wealthiest men in the world, he's not happy. Writing on his X social network, Musk attacked President Trump's very pro-tariff trade advisor, Peter Navarro, and called him a moron.
I mean, that's pretty strong criticism. How is the White House responding to all of this?
Well, on the internal fighting between his advisors, White House Secretary Karoline Leavitt told reporters today that Trump isn't bothered by very different views on tariffs. She also said that almost 70 countries have reached out to Trump and that he's directed his advisors to create what she called tailor-made trade deals for each country. But it's still full speed ahead on some tariffs. The White House also confirmed this afternoon that Trump's tariffs will go into effect just after midnight tonight.
What kind of long-term impact will what we saw today have on everybody's finances?
I think the best thing we can say is that today wasn't as bad as the last few days and didn't do as much damage to Americans' retirement savings. But it also didn't fix anything or restore the trillions of dollars that have been lost from the market since President Trump unveiled these taxes last week.
NPR's Maria Aspen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A measles outbreak in West Texas now includes more than 500 cases, and it spread to two neighboring states. Two children and one adult have died. 2 months in, the spread of measles is increasing. Olivia Aldridge from member station KUT in Austin reports on what it will take to turn that trend around.
Jennifer Nuzzo has seen how measles spreads. As the director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University School of Public Health, she knows the playbook for fighting the highly contagious disease. Identify cases, isolate patients, track who they may have exposed, and most of all, drive up the vaccination rate.
That's the way to stop it. This only ends with immunity.
This strategy isn't novel. The benefits of measles vaccination have been well established for more than half a century. The emergence of the vaccine in the 1960s meant parents no longer had to accept the risks of serious complications and death that came with the common childhood disease. By 2000, measles was considered eliminated in the U.S., thanks to vaccination. But misinformation about the vaccine began to spread around the same time. Catherine Wells is the director of public health in Lubbock, the largest city in the West Texas region affected by the outbreak. At a recent news briefing, Wells said she's seeing the impact of that misinformation today.
Talking to the community, they really stopped vaccinating about 20 years ago, which is in line with what we've seen in other communities across the United States.
The vaccine is safe and effective, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Yet U.S. vaccination rates have dipped for everything from measles to flu in recent years. According to the CDC and Texas's State Health Department, measles immunization rates among Texas and U.S. kindergartners dropped around 2.5% between 2019 and 2023. In rural Gaines County, the epicenter of the West Texas outbreak, only around 82% of kindergartners were vaccinated for measles as of the previous year, far less than the 95% recommended to maintain herd immunity. Wells says she and her colleagues have seen some success ramping up their testing and vaccination efforts, but it's an uphill battle.
The uptake for vaccines definitely been a struggle. I mean, I want to be honest with that.
Wells says her department is conducting contact tracing and letting the public know about possible exposures. Unless Texas declares a public health emergency, local officials can't preemptively quarantine unvaccinated kids. A statement from the state health department said they had no plans to declare an emergency at this time. Meanwhile, a range of bills aimed at loosening vaccine mandates are being considered by the Republican-controlled Texas legislature. After a second child in Texas died last week, America's highest-ranking health official, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., said in a social media statement that vaccines are the most effective way to prevent the spread of measles. But previously, he had downplayed the importance of vaccines and promoted unproven alternate treatments for measles, such as taking vitamin A as a cure. Jennifer Nuzzo at Brown says all of this conflicting messaging adds another layer of difficulty for folks like Wells responding to the outbreak on the ground.
I think the federal communications is muddying the waters and making the jobs that the local officials have in responding to this outbreak harder.
Federal funding changes are also shaping up to be an obstacle. In March, the Department of Government Efficiency announced it would terminate hundreds of millions of dollars in grants to the Texas Department of State Health Services, including funds for more than 50 local health departments. Lubbock's department is one of them. A statement from the city said they're still assessing what the impact of those lost funds will be. Amid these setbacks, the outbreak isn't easing up, and Wells says it's early yet.
This is going to be a large outbreak, and we are still on the side where we are increasing the number of cases.
She says she expects it to be a year before the case count is back to zero. For NPR News, I'm Olivia Aldridge in Austin.
You've probably heard of Bill Nye the Science Guy. Well, now there's Susie Hicks, the climate chick. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports the up-and-coming educator and TV host has a new YouTube series about inspiring little kids to take climate action.
The new series, Susie Hicks, the Climate Chick and Sprout, stars a human.
I'm Susie. I'm a climate advocate. I'm so happy to meet you.
And a fluffy green puppet.
I'm Sprout. I'm a sunflower. I'm just too little to bloom yet.
Together, the pair share information about human-caused climate change, the science, why it's a problem, what can be done about it, in a way that's tailored to suit a young audience.
Can you tell our friends what we're learning about today?
Yes. Today, we're answering the question, what is climate change?
The reason that I talk to young kids is like, what a glorious opportunity to build a better future. I oscillate between, oh my God, we're doomed, and a better world is possible. And I want more people to oscillate towards a better world as possible.
The Susie Hicks and Sprout series on YouTube is part of a small number of climate change-related offerings for kids, such as the Oscar-nominated movie Wild Robot and the Apple Plus TV series Jane.
The animals are in danger. Every year there are less and less of them.
We have to help them.
But a study from the Aspen Institute shows there's not a lot of climate change content aimed at kids. Laura Shifter co-authored the study.
But there are parents that really want to see more of this content to help children understand our changing world and help empower more people in understanding solutions.
One such parent is Cherise Sims. Sims has six kids, lives in Los Angeles, and works as a teacher. She says it's important for children to learn about climate change.
Because this is their world, and it's impacting so many things.
Sims says Susie Hicks, the Climate Chick and Sprout, makes climate change approachable and fun.
Scientists sometimes want to use big words and you just don't understand what they're talking to you about. But with Susie, you understand what you can do.
Our atmosphere is like a big, beautiful blanket around our planet. It works to keep some of the sun's heat from escaping into chilly outer space.
Love that for us.
Hicks is starting to gain recognition, but it's not an easy trail to blaze. They're currently crowdsourcing almost all of the show's funding.
All of my friends have like normal 9-to-5s. And they have healthcare and like they make money and I'm out here like playing with puppets talking about the earth.
But Hicks says they wouldn't have it any other way. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. China's BYD car company is on a hot streak. Last year's sales topped $100 billion. That beat Tesla's global sales. To keep up that stunning growth, the world's largest electric automaker is diving into emerging markets. Analysts say that's a smart move, as President Trump's tariffs and EU trade tensions increasingly close China off from the U.S. and European markets. And south of the border, especially in Brazil, BYD cars are selling big. But as NPR's Carrie Kahn reports, BYD is hitting some speed bumps as well.
Chinese car sales in Brazil are soaring, with BYD's electric autos leading the way. More than 76,000 sold last year, four times more than the previous year. Driver Edmundson Pita is hooked. He's a local police officer by day and Uber driver on nights and weekends. As he follows a driving app through northern Bahia State's capital, Salvador, Pita says he saves so much on gas, he has a hybrid King sedan. On sale now in Salvador, the King runs about $28,000 to $29,000. BYD, whose slogan is Build Your Dreams, has a financing deal with Uber, saving Pita there too. It's taking over, and once the new BYD plant opens in Bahia, it will totally dominate, he says. Pita is talking about BYD's nearly billion-dollar manufacturing complex under construction just 30 miles north in the city of Camaçari. It's key to China's push into Latin America and the global south. BYD says it's planning to put plants in Mexico, Hungary, and Turkey, too. The new factory in Camaçari is huge. When up and running, Chinese officials say it will employ 20,000 workers, building not only cars, but electric batteries, solar panels, and green hydrogen. And in an irony lost on few, the plant is located on Henry Ford Avenue in the U.S. car manufacturer's old plant shuttered 4 years ago when Ford left Brazil. The symbolism is evocative, says Ryan Berg of the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C.
It's a message of we're the future and Ford was the past, that China is a stable and reliable trade partner and the Americans are sometimes not.
Berg studies China's growing influence in Latin America, which is shifting from just building roads and bridges to investing in critical industries. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, personally lobbied for the new plant. BYD declined requests for a factory visit, citing safety concerns during construction, but there wasn't much traffic through its main gate recently. Construction has slowed since Brazilian officials say they were tipped off to, quote, slave-like working conditions by the company.
Os trabalhadores como vítimas de tráfico internacional para efeito de exploração do trabalho escravo.
The workers were victims of international trafficking for the purpose of slave labor, says Rogério Paiva, a press advisor at Bahia's Labor Prosecutor's Office. He says hundreds of Chinese workers were housed in overcrowded, unsanitary dwellings, and many had their passports taken away. BYD says it has fired its Chinese employment firm and is in talks with prosecutors to care for the workers. But negotiations are limping along, no fines have been levied, and the opening date for the plant has been pushed to the end of the year. Julio Bonfim is with Camaçari's Metal Workers Union. He's made it clear to BYD that the union will not permit a large Chinese workforce at the plant and is prepared to call work stoppages if locals aren't dominating the production line. He says he was surprised so many Chinese were brought into Brazil. Despite the tough talk, BYD has yet to finalize a collective bargaining contract. Questions submitted to BYD by NPR were not answered. Locals aren't worrying about future conditions, though. They want jobs now, especially the former Ford workers.
Entrei na Ford, fiquei 18 anos lá. Passou uma boa parte.
Leighton Alder worked at Ford for 18 years. He met his wife on the line, too, and both were laid off when the company left. They pooled their severance pay and moved 30 miles up the coast to build this rustic six-room hostel. We have Wi-Fi, too, for those who want to stay connected, he says, showing off one of the rooms. He's hoping for one of BYD's new jobs. We're going to do everything we can to produce for the company, he says. He knows about the accusations of slave labor and rumored culture clashes working for the Chinese, but he's not worried. I'm sure we will all come to an understanding, he says. And he's very much ready to get back on the line and back to work. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Camisari, Brazil.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One. With the Capital One Saver Card, what's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
Hundreds of thousands of ballots counted in the last presidential election didn't make it to officials until after Election Day. That's because many states give voters a grace period for their absentee ballots to get through the mail. But President Trump recently issued an order that prohibits states from counting those ballots in the future. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports.
The state of Washington is one of about 18 states that counts postmarked ballots that don't make it to officials until after Election Day. Stuart Holmes is the director of elections for Washington's Secretary of State's office. He says this rule actually has a long history in the state.
So all the way back in 1917, we started this tradition and have since modified the language a little bit.
In the past presidential election, Washington state officials counted at least 250,000 mail-in ballots that arrived after Election Day. And according to data provided to NPR, another 170,000 ballots that arrived after Election Day were counted in just six of those 18 states. But when Trump signed his sweeping executive order, which upends a lot of election practices, he said it was to prevent alleged election fraud.
This will go a long way toward ending it. There are other steps that we will be taking as a next in the coming weeks.
But Barbara Smith Warner with the National Vote at Home Institute, which advocates for wider access to mail-in voting, says there's no proof that counting ballots after Election Day makes elections less secure. And she says this isn't something the president can stop states from doing.
The president has no ability to tell the states how to run their elections. That is actually in the Constitution a right that is given to the states.
And in Washington state, election director Stuart Holmes says he and other officials do not want people to lose their vote because of issues with the post office. He says Trump's order will disproportionately affect rural voters and just busy people who remembered to put their ballots in the mail closer to Election Day.
So the impacts for the voters would be substantial and significant, likely resulting in thousands, hundreds of thousands of ballots being rejected simply just based on timeliness alone.
So far, there's been a slew of lawsuits filed against the Trump administration in response to this election order, including one recently filed by 19 states. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump made cognitive testing an issue, even after President Biden dropped out.
We should have cognitive tests for anybody that runs for president.
But how much will President Trump share about his fitness now? We'll listen to how he and his doctors have talked about his health. That's on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, a new PBS documentary that celebrates funk music and its legends.
The funk is, once you get the funk out there, it's not going back. You can't put it back in the box.
The documentary is called We Want the Funk. Learn more about it after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump's trade representative came under fire from senators today over the administration's sweeping tariffs that have heightened the risk of a recession and caused a financial market meltdown. White House Trade Representative Jamison Greer responding to senators' concerns about the president's aggressive bid to raise tariffs on nearly every U.S. trading partner.
Our trade deficit, driven by these non-reciprocal conditions, is a manifestation of the loss of the nation's ability to make, to grow, to build. And the president recognizes the urgency of the moment.
Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon pushing back on Trump's trade representative, saying tariffs make our country less secure.
In Mr. Greer's confirmation hearing, he argued that economic security leads to strong national security. Our country is getting the opposite with these pointless tariffs. Destroying the foundations of our economy is not only disastrous for workers and families, it makes our people less safe.
April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, but the Department of Health and Human Services no longer has a team of prevention experts to call on. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports.
The job cuts were part of a major restructuring of the federal health agencies. Last week, 10,000 employees were fired. Among them were the teams at CDC that help local advocacy groups and public health departments do work on rape prevention. Lynn Rosenthal was HHS Director of Sexual and Gender-Based Violence under the Biden administration.
Decades, literally, of work will be lost as a result of the Division of Violence Prevention being wiped out in this way.
The $200 million appropriated to the CDC's Rape Prevention and Education Program hasn't been cut, but local groups worry that they'll have problems receiving their funding now that their federal partners are gone.
This is NPR. The State Department says it's aware of reports that two Chinese citizens were caught in Ukraine fighting on behalf of Russia. The news is adding to the Trump administration's growing frustration in getting a ceasefire deal. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce says it is disturbing to see Chinese citizens fighting on behalf of Russia in Ukraine.
China is a major enabler of Russia in the war in Ukraine. China provides nearly 80% of the dual-use items Russia needs to sustain the war. 80% comes from China.
She says the U.S. will know in a matter of weeks whether Russia is serious about peace. Bruce adds that a deadly Russian ballistic missile strike on President Volodymyr Zelensky's hometown further heightens, in her words, President Trump's urgent call for peace. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Floodwaters slowly receding across Kentucky, allowing residents there to return to their homes to assess the damage. Heavy rain and destructive tornadoes over the past week have killed at least 23 people. Flood danger remains high in other states as well, including parts of Tennessee, Arkansas, and Indiana. Meanwhile, power outages continue in areas from Texas to parts of Ohio. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists
providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Today in upstate New York, many people in the tiny town of Sackett's Harbor are celebrating the return of a migrant family detained last month by federal immigration police. The mother and three children, who don't have legal status, were taken during a nighttime raid on a dairy farm, and they were sent to a detention facility in Texas. Now, the governor of New York says the family has been freed after a protest march over the weekend and after both Republican and Democratic politicians lobbied for their return. NPR's Brian Mann is in Sackett's Harbor, which is near the U.S.-Canada border. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so this family, who I understand government officials are not naming for privacy reasons, they're coming home. Can you just tell us what people in Sackett's Harbor are saying about this return?
Yeah, a lot of people I've spoken to today are overjoyed. These three kids are enrolled in the Sackett's Harbor schools. Really well-liked, people say. I spoke to Berlin Urbina, who's 19 years old, and she went to school with these kids. She was part of a big protest march over the weekend demanding their return. And Urbina told me she was shocked that it seems to have worked.
It is amazing. You know, a lot of places probably would have just been like, oh, that sucks, they're gone. They wouldn't have done anything about it. But I think because this is such a small community and it impacted us so greatly, everybody came together and was able to make that happen.
And Elsa, I understand from local officials here that these kids will be back in school this week.
Wow. But Brian, I mean, this seems kind of rare, right? Like that the Trump administration would release immigrants without legal status in this particular way. Like, how did this situation happen?
Yeah, there are some unique details here. Sackett's Harbor happens to be near the town where the Trump administration's border czar Tom Homan grew up, and protesters over the weekend actually marched past Homan's vacation home here.
Tom Homan took our kids!
Tom Homan took our kids!
Now, Homan was not in upstate New York when that protest happened, but then a Republican state lawmaker intervened, as did local farmers. Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul also got involved. And I spoke to Hochul about this a short time ago today.
I spoke to Tom Homan yesterday, who confirmed that they've been released from the detention center in Texas. I don't know if they're going right to the farm or to a place to hold until all the attention dies down. And this is a family that's been traumatized.
Hochul told me this family didn't know until this week whether they would be flown to another country, as many migrants without legal papers have experienced in recent weeks. She described their experience as a living hell. In a statement, U.S. Customs and Border Protection said this family was actually caught up in a raid that was focused on possible criminal activity by another foreign national. In an interview with Fox News, Tom Homan said this mother and her children were being interviewed as possible victims or witnesses before their release from that migrant detention facility.
But I'm wondering, I mean, because I understand that Sackett's Harbor, it's in a conservative part of New York, a region that voted for Trump. Have you been able to talk to people who supported detaining this family?
Well, Trump supporters here tell me they're really conflicted. Over the weekend, reporters with our member station, North Country Public Radio, spoke with a guy named Don Pitcher who lives here. He actually opposed bringing this family back. He took part in a counter protest supporting these deportations over the weekend. He said he's had difficult conversations about all this with his own daughter, who attends school with these kids who were detained.
She knows where I stand on immigration. And she's looking at me, why them, Dad? I go, listen, I try to explain it to her. It's tough. It's real tough. They're still hurting. The whole school's hurting.
So there's a real debate even inside families here over how this played out, Elsa.
That is NPR's Brian Mann in Sackett's Harbor, New York. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
President Trump is boasting that he's wheeling and dealing to cut deals on tariffs, but for weeks, his own aides insisted that tariffs were not a bargaining chip. As NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez reports, that has put increased scrutiny on two of President Trump's cabinet members who have to try to explain these mixed messages.
Last month, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent laid the ground for tariffs by warning Americans that long-term economic gain could not occur without some short-term pain.
Access to cheap goods is not the essence
of the American dream.
And Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, was often by Trump's side. He did dozens of interviews, like this one on CNBC, channeling Trump's tough rhetoric.
We need to stop supporting the rest of the world and start supporting American workers.
Lutnick on CNN last week insisted it was too late for countries to try and negotiate.
I don't think there's any chance that President Trump's going to back off his tariffs. This is the reordering of global trade.
Yet, within hours, Trump told reporters on Air Force One that he would be open to negotiating.
And every country's calling us. That's the beauty of what we do. We put ourselves in the driver's seat.
Lutnick was standing right behind him. It's just the latest example of how hard it can be for aides to try and sell Trump's ever-evolving trade agenda. Lutnick used to run the financial services firm Cantor Fitzgerald. Bessent is a former hedge fund investor. Trump has a lot of people in his ear on trade. Bessent and Lutnick were picked in part to assure Wall Street that there were steady stewards at the helm.
What you've seen for the last two plus months is evidence that, in fact, Bessent is not in charge of foreign economic policy. Neither is Lutnick. It's Donald Trump.
Daniel Dresner is a former international economist at Treasury and a former Republican. The Tufts University professor says business leaders have grown frustrated with Lutnick over the tariff rollout. Top aides have a fine line to walk when their boss changes his message, says Caitlin Legacki, who was a senior advisor in Joe Biden's Commerce Department.
Especially for people like Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, there's huge potential damage to their reputations outside of Washington, D.C.
They also risk being blamed by Trump if he doesn't think their sales job was good enough. Bessent and Lutnick on Sunday tried to do some damage control. Bessent on NBC was cautious when asked directly if the tariffs were permanent.
Well, I think that's going to be a decision for President Trump, but I can tell you that as only he can do at this moment, he's created maximum leverage for himself.
But over on CBS, Lutnick sought to hold the line.
There's no postponing. They are definitely going to stay in place for days and weeks. That is sort of obvious. The president needs to reset global trade.
Kush Desai, a White House spokesman, said Trump has assembled the, quote, best and brightest economic team in modern history. He says they're all working in the country's best interest to address trade deficits. That team also includes other White House aides, Peter Navarro, Kevin Hassett, and Jameson Greer. Trump acknowledged yesterday that there have been different messages about whether the tariffs are negotiable or are they here to stay, and he was okay with it.
They can both be true. There can be permanent tariffs, and there can also be negotiations because there are things that we need beyond tariffs.
The markets are still in turmoil. Republican strategist Alex Conan, who represents some companies impacted by the tariffs, says it didn't have to be this bad. Wall Street could have prepared better if it knew better what was coming.
Their messaging is all over the place. They talk about the need for tariffs to cut the deficit. They talk about the need for tariffs to bring manufacturing jobs home. But they also talk about the need for tariffs in order to make trade more fair. All three of those cannot be true at the same time.
Which Conan says is why this is such a tough sales job. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump's sweeping cuts at federal health agencies include the Coal Workers Health Surveillance Program. Over the past half century, that program dramatically reduced black lung disease, which once sickened or killed over a third of miners. Mining communities must now grapple with its disappearance. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
Sam Petsonk grew up in southern West Virginia, visiting patients with his father, one of the country's first doctors to specialize in black lung disease.
When I was a child, I'd look up and I'd see coal miners seeming larger than life, you know, doubled over, coughing, scarcely able to walk, work, or breathe.
Today, Petsonk's entire law practice represents coal miners sickened on the job. For his work, he relies heavily on a unit of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which runs the Coal Workers Health Surveillance Program. The program ran a very unique kind of workplace health benefit. By law, it gave every miner in the country access to care for free.
It sent mobile X-ray units to mines for regular screenings. It authorized job transfers for miners showing signs of disease. And the 25-person unit also trained and certified doctors to read specialized lung scans. Petsonk says it's an essential part of mining life. But as of last week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention slashed staff, and it is not operating.
The bedrock institution for the medical profession that has been obliterated. It's just unacceptable.
Yesterday, Petsonk filed suit against Health and Human Services and its new head, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., to reinstate the unit. Epidemiologist Scott Laney headed research at that Morgantown, West Virginia office until he was placed on administrative leave on April 1st.
We are the nation's doctors for coal miners when it comes to their lung health.
Laney says with no staff, the Coal Worker Health Surveillance Program and its database of X-rays, medical records, and mobile screening vans are abandoned. He says his unit single-handedly reduced rates of black lung disease among longtime miners from about 40% to under 5%. But it's still a huge concern today, as coal mines cut more from sandstone, which generates dust 20 times more harmful than coal. Without monitoring, Laney says, coal miners will die and no one will keep score.
It's going to have impacts on my neighbors. It's going to be killing young men, and that story will go untold.
Dr. Drew Harris says most miners are unaware of the program's recent fate. Harris is a pulmonologist who directs the Black Lung Program at Stone Mountain Health, the only such free clinic in Virginia.
We hear coal trains running behind the clinic intermittently throughout the day.
Harris says the lung surveillance program is trusted and universally relied upon.
In Central Appalachia, it's a big deal. And these are towns that basically were built around coal mining. And coal miners are like the heart and soul of this community and sort of the economic livelihood for generations.
Harris says high levels of sand dust mean some patients need double lung transplants by age 40. The program, he says, is still very necessary.
If that goes away, then, you know, people won't know that they have black lung at an earlier age, and more people are going to end up with severe disease because they didn't diagnose it earlier.
Officials from CDC and Health and Human Services did not respond to requests for comment. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang.
Major storms dumped heavy rain on the Ohio River Valley last week, killing more than 24 people across 7 states. Days later, that rainwater is moving through creeks and rivers, causing them to crest at near record levels. Kentucky Public Radio's Justin Hicks captured the scene on the ground in the state.
It was finally a day of sunshine, and James Cornish stood with his family on the side of the highway in Frankfort, Kentucky, the state's Capitol Dome visible in the distance. They're stunned, staring at his father's and uncle's houses. Both are surrounded by brown water, inaccessible until the river goes down.
We're just looking at our family's home. Luckily, it didn't get so high to where it's a total loss. Unlike people in the very back, as you can see, they're 4, 5, 6, maybe 6 feet deep in the water, and we only got about 18 inches.
His uncle, 78-year-old Russell Harrod, drives up in a truck. This is the first time he's seen his home since fleeing from the rising waters. He cranes his neck, trying to see if it seeped into his windows and doors.
Yeah, I don't know if it's in there or not. Yeah, it looks like I can't, if I can see that window sill, it's probably in there.
In a briefing today, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear said 4 people have died in his state from the storm. So far, emergency managers estimate hundreds of homes are damaged or destroyed, and the crisis isn't over yet.
Not all rivers have crested, and where they have, it's going to take a while. You are still in danger if you drive through water, and never go around those barricades.
Beshear says in western Kentucky and several Ohio River towns, flooding will likely continue into next week. In the meantime, the White House approved Kentucky's emergency request to help rescue and recovery efforts. Beshear says he'll seek other federal aid programs that will allow people to apply for grants to clean and repair their homes.
I certainly believe there's enough damage in a number of our counties to qualify for it. We've just got to make sure that we gather the right information.
Back in Frankfort, Charlene Quammen says her neighborhood hasn't flooded like this since she was little in the late 70s. And remembering that experience, she prepared for the worst.
You come look at my house.
Inside, couches are still stacked on top of each other and rugs are on the tables. But water never reached her first floor. Then Quammen opens the door to the basement.
When I say that we're lucky, I mean, this is lucky.
A recycling bin is floating and bobbing in the floodwater, just about a foot below the top stair. She'll have to wait for the water to go down before she can clean, but that could take days. The National Weather Service is forecasting scattered thunderstorms for the region Wednesday night and Thursday. Officials say they could bring another half an inch of rain to some areas, prolonging the flooding. For NPR News, I'm Justin Hicks in Frankfort.
We Want the Funk is a sprawling, comprehensive documentary about funk music debuting today on PBS's Independent Lens series. NPR TV critic Eric Dagan sat down with filmmaker Stanley Nelson and funk legend George Clinton to talk about why it's not just a documentary, it's a celebration.
We Want the Funk begins with a funky bass line from legendary studio musician Marcus Miller, a groove from James Brown, and an existential question. What exactly is the funk? Todd Boyd, an expert on race and pop culture at the University of Southern California, tries to explain...
What is funk? Well, it's funky. But beyond that, I don't know if I can describe it, but when you hear it, you know what it is.
But the truth is, funk, a danceable blend of R&B, jazz, gospel, and more, defies easy definition. So I asked the man who co-wrote the song that gives the documentary its name, Parliament Funkadelic leader George Clinton, why is it so hard to define the funk?
I know why you're confused like that, because it's an attitude.
You know, we spent a lot of time in the edit room because we had to kind of make up a story.
That's co-director and Emmy-winning filmmaker Stanley Nelson. He eventually shaped a story looking back to the 1950s and 60s when white acts dominated TV shows like American Bandstand and black-centered Motown Records offered a smooth version of R&B aimed at not offending white people. But as the 60s evolved, black people wanted a bolder musical identity. And along came James Brown in 1968 with a powerful, funky anthem, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, as his trombonist Fred Wesley explains in the film.
We were in California at the time. James Brown brought a bunch of kids in the studio, and he said, say it loud, and they said, I'm black and I'm proud.
Around the same time, George Clinton was working as a staff songwriter at Motown and had a vocal group called The Parliaments. They had a Motown-style R&B hit called I Wanna Testify. But then something changed to push them towards the funk.
As soon as we got a hit record, it was the same year that Sgt. Pepper came out. All of that rock stuff came out. I could see it was getting ready to make one of those paradigm shifts.
In the film, Nelson gets musicians to demonstrate how funk music works, like guitarist Carlos Alomar playing the hit he co-wrote with David Bowie, Fame.
When you have those three guitar parts answering each other, perfect syncopation,
he was in heaven.
Later in the film, Clinton admits the groove for the chorus line, We Want the Funk, was inspired by Fame. And Talking Heads leader David Byrne says their hit title, Burning Down the House, was inspired by a chant that Clinton and Parliament were saying during live shows, but never recorded. Burning down
the house. They never used it in a song.
We did it for so long, I didn't even realize we hadn't put it on record till they put it out.
We Want the Funk covers a lot of ground, from Sly and the Family Stone to Prince, hip-hop pioneers like De La Soul, and the influence of groups like Parliament Funkadelic on black-centered science fiction, presenting the music as a primary expression of black culture that always endures.
We're not looking at the funk like disco. The funk is once you get the funk out there, it's not going back. You can't put it back in the box.
Clinton says if he ever does get to meet an alien, he wants to make sure of one thing.
I just want to make sure they can dance, you know, like Hook said. That's the main thing, you know. I got a booty, you got a booty, we can work it out on the dance floor.
Something tells me if aliens are dancing, George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic will likely provide the soundtrack. I'm Eric Deggins.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Mathnasium. Whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at cunard.com.